Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 14 in our series on the book of Acts. We'll be in Acts chapter 10, verses 1 through 23 today. And the title of our lesson is Peter and Cornelius, Part 1. Now, the Part 1 is, of course, that we will be splitting this chapter into two lessons just to make it fit into a nice size lesson. So, we're not going to finish our story today. We will be finishing it in the next lesson. So, but there's still quite a bit of ground we're going to cover. There's a lot that goes on here. Now, before I get started, let me go ahead and throw in a quick word of apology. It has been quite a while since I have been able to do any recording and post anything. As it stands right now, this is lesson number 14. I actually have notes prepared all the way through lesson 18, and coming up, well, tomorrow I will be working probably on lesson number 19 for Sunday. So I'm running a little bit behind on my lessons. If you have visited the front page of BaptistBasics.org in the last little bit, and so this is the end of October 2010, but if you have visited any time recently, you will have seen that my wife and I have welcomed the birth of our third child, our first girl, little Jenna. And so we've been a little bit preoccupied, so I figure that is a good excuse, and if once you see how cute she is, you'll understand. So, but anyway, so with that and some other circumstances, the change of seasons has really thrown my voice for a loop. I've had an awful time with seasonal allergies, so I figured that you probably did not want to listen to me hack and cough and sneeze the whole time, and I probably still am going to be doing a little bit of that, but finally getting a nice little quiet time here to try to squeeze some recording in. I want to take advantage of it. So let's go ahead and jump into our lesson. Now, what we're doing here in the first half of this story that we'll cover in this lesson is setting the stage for one of the most important events in the book of Acts. This is the gospel is finally given to the Gentiles. Now, this takes place, from what I've read, around 40 AD. So we're talking about 10 years after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ that the first record of a Gentile being saved. We'll think, wait a minute, Matt. What about the Ethiopian eunuch? And there have been some non-Jewish blood people get saved, people who, you know, do not trace their ancestry back to David and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That is correct. But the people who have gotten saved that were not of Jewish blood to this point were all Jewish proselytes. That is, they had adopted Jewish practice. They had basically been brought into the Jewish fold, even though they were not of the same blood and the same kindred. They were practicing Jews in every other sense. There were regulations regarding this in the law. If you want to go back and you can study that out, that this was okay. You know, that outsiders could come in and basically become Jews. There were some limits because they were not of Jewish blood, but for all practical purposes, they were Jews. So that would explain why the Ethiopian eunuch was going there to worship. This wasn't a sightseeing tour or just, you know, curiosity. He was going there to worship. Now, most people generally agree that Cornelius is the first truly Gentile, non-Jewish person to be saved. That is, he is of Gentile blood. He is not a practicing Jew. Now, the story, once we get into it, we'll see that Cornelius may not be a practicing Jew, may not be an official Jewish proselyte, but he is attempting to worship the God of the Jews. So this is not someone who is ready to go and offer sacrifices to Jupiter or, you know, Zeus, depending on, you know, Greek or Roman god there. But, you know, this is not necessarily someone who's on their way to go worship at a Greek or Roman temple. This guy is leaning towards the Jewish religion. He's actually beginning to practice it in some context. And God looks down on him and sees what he is doing, sees his heart, and is going to allow him to be, for, according to the gospel record and according to the fallout from this, is almost certainly this is the very first Gentile, non-Jewish person, non-practicing Jew to be saved. Now, as I say, when we get into this, we'll see that Cornelius is doing some stuff, but I think just from the fallout, there was no fallout from the Ethiopian eunuch being saved. When we get into this, there is going to be some fallout. We're going to talk about Cornelius in today's lesson, in lesson number 15, and also in lesson 16, in chapter 11, Peter is going to have to defend what happened. So I think that the fact that he had to defend it meant something very momentous, something extraordinary had happened, and that is the very first Gentile person was saved. So let's see here. We're just going to be setting up the conversion of Cornelius. In today's lesson, we'll talk about, you know, Cornelius, who he was a little bit. We're going to see that he was worshiping God, that he had some works that he was performing, and God's going to reveal to him through an angel, through a vision, to contact Peter. And Peter is going to have to be prepared by God to do this. Jews and Gentiles did not get along. Jews did just practically hated everybody that was not a Jew. So God has to soften up Peter through a very famous vision. He's going to be up on top of the roof praying, and God's going to have, there's going to be a vision of a great sheet coming down with a bunch of animals he's not supposed to eat or touch. And God's going to use that to get it through his thick head that, hey, it's okay for Gentiles to be saved. And that's basically where we're going to get through today. So I don't expect this. I mean, I've rambled already for about 7 minutes, but I don't expect this to be too long. I think we'll get along pretty good. Okay, as far as the setting goes, I've already mentioned this takes place somewhere around 40 AD, according to what I've looked up. That your guess is as good as mine, but based on the other events around, it looks like about 40 AD. And there's going to be two cities we're going to deal with. The first is Caesarea. Now, Caesarea is a Jewish port city, which is a rare thing. The coastline of Israel is not a good place for harbors. There are no natural harbors. This harbor basically had to be man-made. And it was there was some village and stuff there, but basically the town itself was officially built by Herod the Great in 25 BC. And also a further note that this is the capital of the Roman province of Judea. So this is not just any town. This is the Roman capital. They did not set up shop at Jerusalem, even though they had a presence there. As far as, you know, the courts and stuff were concerned, the legal matters and the taxation stuff, the capital of the province was Caesarea. And this town is about 30 miles north of Joppa. Now, we've already talked, I believe, let me go back, it's been a while. We've already set up that Peter is at Joppa and talked a little bit about where that is. But this is about 30 miles north of there, so it's a pretty good day's travel to be there. So that's Caesarea. The second town, of course, is Joppa. We talked about in our last lesson, which seems like a long time ago for me. But it's also known as Jaffa. If you want to look it up on a map today, it's another Jewish port city. It's nothing compared to Caesarea. It's about 40 miles west of Jerusalem. And this is where Peter has been since the events of Acts chapter 9, since the raising of Tabitha. And he has been hanging out there with a guy named Simon the Tanner. And I don't know if I spoke much about what the tanner was. This was a guy that would prepare animal hides and for parchment and leather. Not the nicest place to be. Basically, you're around a butcher shop, and because of the stuff they would do to cure the leather, this is not exactly, you know, the five-star hotel. This is not exactly probably the cleanest or nicest place to be, but this is where Peter is, just to kind of set the stage and give you a little bit of middle picture. So let's get started, And we're in Acts chapter 10. We'll look at verse 1. There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called the Italian band. And let's go ahead and read verse 2. A devout man, and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. All right, so let's look about what we know about Cornelius right here, just in these two verses. We see, number one, his name is Cornelius. That is a Gentile name. So this is a Gentile. He's a centurion. A centurion was an officer in the Roman army. I would kind of, you could probably place it along like a sergeant or a lieutenant in today's army. He had number men. Now, as far as the size of a century, it's a little bit hard to guess. I mean, you want to say century is 100, so therefore he was over 100 people. And that's kind of approximate. By this point in time in Roman history, you know, some of those names don't exactly have their literal meaning with some of the reorganization in new, I want to say strategery. Oh, pop culture stuff popping your head again. But all the new strategies and military philosophy that was in place at the time. So, but he was in charge of about 100 or so people. And so this is an offer. This isn't just, you know, some no name. This is a guy who probably is of some type of equestrian, maybe not equestrian, but he is of a higher rank. This is not a no name guy. He probably has some family. He's working his way up in the Roman army and up the Roman political scale. And probably a younger person. This is not, you know, something a 50-year-old guy would most likely be doing. This guy's probably in his 20s, maybe 30s, as he is, you know, working his way up the Roman ladder. So we see he's a centurion of a band, which actually that word there is cohort. That's a division of the Roman army. And I'm going to reference the article on Wikipedia. I've got it pulled up here on cohort. And let me give you the numbers they have. And as I say, some of this is very up for interpretation because times and circumstances would probably, there's exceptions to all this. But the way that they describe, it's described in this Wikipedia article, is that a legion at this time, which legion means about 1,000, but a Roman legion would have about 5,400 men. That's including officers and usually a small cavalry unit of around 120 men and horses. This legion of, you know, 5,400 people would be divided into six centuries, which we talked about, which would be about 80 men, each one headed by a centurion. Now, some of these units would be double. According to this article, in the first century AD, which is, of course, when this took place, that there was a little bit of a restructuring so that the different cohorts were ranked according to seniority, and they actually have different titles for them. I'm not even going to try to pronounce. You can look it up. And that the different cohorts inside... Okay, wait. Excuse me. A legion would be divided into cohorts, 10 cohorts. So you'd have about 500 some odd men in each one. These would be divided into six centuries. So if you're confused, I apologize. I'm confused reading this, trying to get this explained. So, and depending on the seniority of the centurion would be which of these centuries he would be in charge of. And the first... some of these would be double strength and stuff like that. And that's as simple as I'm going to get. I don't want to sit here and just read it verbatim off of there, but that'll give you an idea of what we're talking about. So let's see here. Where was I? Let's see. He's a centurion of in the band, this cohort. The cohort is called the Italian cohort. So this unit was made up of people from Italy, from the Roman mainland. This is really something kind of interesting here, that this guy would be of Roman blood. This is not a Syrian or an Egyptian. According to some of the history books and stuff I've read, most of the Roman legionaries at the time were actually Syrian. They, you know, they were from the frontiers. They were not Roman blooded citizens. But this guy was from Italy. So this guy actually is one of the people that is really highly despised by the Jews because, you know, hey, look, these guys are in charge. This is the occupying force. These are the foreigners that are making them pay taxes. And, you know, there's already been rebellions. So just to take it even a step further with this guy, he's not just a Gentile, not just a non-Jew. This guy is a Roman. And he is from over there. He's not a Roman citizen from some outlying colony. No, this guy is a Roman, as far as we can tell here. We also see that he's a devout man. They feared God with all his house. So this guy worshiped God. As I say, this is where it gets kind of tricky. You know, why isn't the Ethiopian eunuch the first Jew to be saved, or the first Gentile to be saved? Most people consider Cornelius, but yet Cornelius is worshiping the God Jehovah, the Jewish God. We see he's devout, that he feared capital G God. He's not fearing gods, plural, but he's fearing the true God, worshiping the true God. Talks about his actions, that he gave alms, that's charitable giving to the people, which is rare because most Romans would just spit on a Jew as look at him and would, you know, take advantage of them in any way possible. They were a second-class citizen, you know, or actually most of the time they weren't even citizens. So, you know, they're treated as slaves and conquered people. So, but we see, so this guy actually appears to be a great man, a good-hearted man, that he's helping people. We see prayed to God always. So this guy already has a relationship with God, and is seeking God, is trying to worship God, and God in his mercy is going to look down, and in his grace is going to reveal to him the true gospel of Jesus Christ. Verse number 3. He saw in a vision, evidently about the ninth hour of the day. Now, with the Roman times there, excuse me, with the Roman times, that would actually place this sometime around 3 in the afternoon. Their hours would begin count at daylight, so you're assuming 6 hours or so till noon. So this is middle to late afternoon that this takes place. About the ninth hour of the day, an angel of God coming to him and saying unto him, Cornelius. Isn't it good that God knows your name? You know, he doesn't just come down, you know, but when he sends a message to you, when he wants to get in contact with you, he knows your name. You know, this angel knew his name, Cornelius. Verse 4. And when he looked on him, he was afraid and said, what is it, Lord? So he knew what was going on. He realized, you know, not necessarily that God was talking to him, but he knew that this was a message for God. He knew what was going on, understood it. And he, that's the angel, said to him, thy prayers and thine alms are come up for a memorial before God. So God has looked down and taken note of this guy. He has seen the works that he has done and has paid attention to him. So God wasn't ignoring this non-Jewish person. Isn't that good that God would look down on the man who is not saved as of yet and still realize what he's doing and realize that he's trying and looks down on him and says, I want this guy to be the first Gentile to be saved. He's really diligently seeking me. He's trying to serve me. I want this guy. So Angel Gabriel, you know, whatever angel, said, you know, go down there and tell, I got a message for this guy. Verse 5. Now send men to Joppa and call for one Simon, whose surname is Peter. Verse 6. He lodgeth with one Simon the Tanner, whose house is by the seaside, which is probably where it would be, because that way a lot of the stink would go out into the ocean. He shall tell thee what thou oughtest to do. So, here we go. The angel has given Cornelius his orders, and as a good soldier, he's going to follow them. Verse 7, and when the angel which spake unto Cornelius was departed, he called two of his household servants and a devout soldier of them that waited on him continually. Verse 8, and when he had declared all these things unto them, he sent them to Joppa. So he sends this three-man delegation to them. A couple of them are just household servants. They're most likely slaves. And, who knows what nationality they are. But because it talks about his house serving God in verse 2, these guys are probably believers and worshipers of the true God also. And also one of his soldiers. So not he also sends a military escort with these guys, you know, to make sure that there is no trouble. Which, as I say, you know, a Roman, any sign of Roman authority, well, it might get you a little bit of trouble, but also it's going to keep you out of a lot of trouble because most of the Jews realize you don't mess with Rome by this time, because every time they tried to revolt, something bad happened. So here we go. This three-man delegation, these two servants and this soldier have gone to Joppa. Now say it's about 30 miles south of there. And that is a very long journey. We're going to see that they leave there and they're going to get there actually the next day, I believe it is, around the same time. So it took them about 24 hours to get down there. It appears that, from what I can study, that this trip would actually take someone just traveling not in a hurry, would take a little bit more than daylight would allow. This is probably something that you would at some point stop for the night and camp or try to get in to some type of inn. This would take a little bit longer than a full day would allow. So that's why we're going to see they leave, and it's going to take to the next day to get down there. So verse 9, on the morrow, as they went on their journey, they drew nigh unto the city, and Peter went up unto the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. Okay, once again, Roman time here. This is sometime around noontime. And verse 10, he became very hungry, which is what we all do about noontime, and would have eaten, but while they made ready, he fell into a trance. Okay, let's talk about this. I know I've talked about this before, but with Jewish houses at the time, they would have flat roofs. They would often build a little gazebo-type thing on top. That is where Peter is. He's up on this rooftop. He's sitting in there. He's up there praying, and he's getting hungry. He calls for the servant and says, hey, guys, why don't y'all get lunch ready? And while they're getting lunch ready, God's going to give him this vision. Verse 11, talking about Peter, and saw heaven open, and a certain vessel descending unto him, as it had been a great sheet, knit at all four corners, and let down to the earth. Verse 12, wherein were all manner of four-footed beasts of the earth, and wild beasts, and creeping things, and fowls of the air. Okay, so let's kind of set this up. He's seeing this vision. He looks up in the sky. It says the heavens open. That's a very common thing with these visions. Even in the book of Revelation, you see the same type of thing. So the clouds must part or something, but it's like, you know, an opening. Somebody opens a door in the sky, and out comes this sheet. Now, it's bundled up. It talks about the four corners. So imagine you take the four corners of a sheet, and you take them in your hand, you lift it up, and it's full of something. It's going to make a little bulge. That's what this what I picture this looking like is if you just had all four corners in the sheet and we're dropping it down. I don't know why the picture in my mind is like in the cartoons where you have a stork delivering the baby. I think the movie Dumbo has it, and that's kind of what I picture. This white sheet, you know, and it's kind of tied together in a nice little knot, and it's you know there's something there, there's this bundle, but you don't know what it is. So this sheet comes down. Now in it, it's very interesting what's in there. What is in there is a bunch of animals that the Jews were not allowed to eat. Now you can go back and reference this back in the Mosaic Law, and you can go and read the Jewish traditions that added to that. But basically everything that was in there was something Peter was not supposed to eat. He really wasn't supposed to even touch. There's, you know, probably pigs in there. That's kind of the most famous thing with the Jewish diet. You know, they're not allowed to eat pork or bacon, and don't know how they get by without bacon. But so basically, what is in there is all this stuff he's not supposed to eat. So verse 13. Now here's the strange part. And there came a voice to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." Isn't that a great message for a lot of people take that to heart? All these hunters, you know, let's get up, go kill and eat. Yes, very good. I like the eating part. You can handle the killing part and the slaughtering and stuff, and I'll handle the eating part. You got that under control. So, but anyway, here comes the command. Now, this baffles Peter's Jewish mind. He's like, wait a minute, what, you want me to eat that? No, I'm not supposed to eat that. So verse 14, but Peter said, "Not so, Lord." So he's arguing with God. Peter does that quite a bit, if you notice. "For I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean." So he's saying common is base. It's not, you know, everyday. Don't think of everyday. It's talking about something that's base. Now you can reference back, cross-reference here is Leviticus 11, verse 1. But anyway, these are common, these are unclean, these are things that were forbidden in the Mosaic Law. He's not supposed to eat them. So verse 15, and the voice spake unto him again the second time, "What God hath cleansed, thou that call not thou common." So kind of a tongue twister there, but the voice tells him, look, if God has said it's clean, don't you argue and don't you say it's unclean. There we go. That's the Texas translation of what it said. Verse 16 is very interesting. This takes place three times. This was done thrice, and the vessel was received up again into heaven. So three times, the sheet's there. There's these pigs and other stuff in there that Peter is not supposed to eat. And three times, God says, Peter, eat it. Peter says, no way, I'm not going to eat that. And then God says, Peter, if I say eat it, you know, don't argue. So three times this takes place. Does that ring a bell? Something happening with Peter three times? Could it be referenced back to denying the Lord three times? I think there is. You know, Peter, we've already seen, is hard-headed. This whole thing just fits so perfectly in this image of Peter that we have. Just compare this part to to Peter denying the Lord. It just the fact that it's all three times, the fact that he's not fully obeying and not realizing it at the time. It's only later he realizes what he's done. To me, this is like the same story just played out in a different manner. So anyway, the vision ends and the sheet is taken back up into heaven. It's verse 7. Now, while Peter doubted himself what this vision, which he had seen, what should mean. So he's like, what in the world does this mean? Behold, the men which were sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate. So they're outside of the house, outside probably when we're talking about gates, probably like a little courtyard area there beside the house. And they're outside, they've knocked on the door, and you know, the servant has answered, and they said, look, we're asking for Peter. And I'm sure they're really concerned. There's a Roman soldier out there. What do they want with Peter? He's already been arrested before. So as he's sitting there, the vision ends. I just imagine as soon as the vision ends, there's a knock at the door, and here are Cornelius's men looking for him. Verse 18, and called and asked whether Simon, which was surnamed Peter, were lodged there. I'm having trouble with some of this today. So verse 19, while the Peter thought on the vision, the Spirit said unto him, behold, three men seek thee. So God tells him, look, hey, get three guys looking for you. Verse 20, arise therefore and get thee down and go with them, doubting nothing. I've got that underlined in my Bible. Boy, that's a hard one to do, even today, let alone all the crazy things that are going on in Peter's mind. But just to go and obey God and not doubt, that is truly a struggle that we all face. Continuing says, for I have sent them. So God tells Peter, while he's still trying to figure out what in the world was this vision about, why was the sheep and the pigs and catfish and other stuff in there he wasn't supposed to eat? What does this mean? And then God says, hey, Peter, one more thing. I forgot to tell you. There's three guys looking for you. Go with them and trust me. So I imagine Peter's like, okay, well, after the vision of the sheep and the animals, at least this is clear cut and I know what I'm supposed to do. I understand this. So verse 21, then Peter went down to the men. So he goes off, gets down off the house, goes out, meets the men, which had sent unto him from Cornelius, and said, behold, I am he whom ye seek. What is the cause wherewith you're come? So listen, Peter still has no clue. He's just obeying God's command. He just goes up to him, like, hey, guys, I'm Peter. I'm the guy you're looking for. Now, what do you need? So verse 22, and they said, Cornelius the centurion, a just man and one that feareth God and of good report among all the nation of the Jews, was warned from God by an holy angel to send for thee into his house and to hear words of thee. So they just tell him what their mission is. Hey, Cornelius sent us. By the way, he's a great guy. He loves God. All the Jews like him, so you don't have to be afraid. He's on your side. And said, look, God spoke to him through an angel, and we're supposed to come get you, and you need to come back, and we want to know what God's trying to tell us. So verse 23, then called he them in and lodged them. And on the morrow, Peter went away with them, and certain brethren from Joppa accompanied him. Now, I know I'm kind of ending, if you got a Schofield Bible, I've kind of crossed over into the next section there. But I want to keep what happens at Joppa in Joppa. And next time we'll take up with what happens in Caesarea. So, but it's also very interesting right away that he invites these Gentiles in. This is something Jews were not supposed to do. They weren't really supposed to have, they were not supposed to have hardly any doings at all with Gentiles. They were not supposed to have them in their house. They were not supposed to eat with them. They were not supposed to lodge with them. And yet he invites these guys in. Now, this took place around noontime. Why didn't he just get out and go with them? Well, because they were going to wait till the morning. That way they could get there, in the day's journey. All right. And with that, we'll call it a lesson. We'll continue on with the story of Peter and Cornelius and the conversion of the first Gentile in lesson number 15, which hopefully I do not take 6 weeks to get out this time. In fact, I'm going to have to do some major recording to get caught up. But anyway, I appreciate you listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. If this is the first one you've stumbled across, check out BaptistBasics.org. Click on the BBU for Baptist Basics University tab, and you can see some of the other lessons that I have, and check out the website, the articles, different things about Baptist history. I've got some stuff about J. Frank Norris, my kind of fascination with him and his ministry. I've got some new stuff up about him. Feel free to contact me at the email address, podcast@baptistbasics.org. And as I say, just check out all the other things that are going on there. And I'll quit rambling. We'll call it a lesson, and I will see you next time. Thanks.